My first guests this morning are Marcia Torobin. She's director of the Santa Fe Jewish Film Festival, and cinematographer Diana Taylor of Santa Fe. And we're going to be talking about a very fabulous film called Hava Negila. Good morning, ladies. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
Great. So, Marcia, tell me about the Jewish Film Festival, how it got started, what its purpose is.
It started a couple of years ago under the auspices of one of Santa Fe synagogues, Hamakom. But by the second year, it was clear that it had much more broader appeal. About 80% of the audience was from the larger Santa Fe community. And so this past year, we reorganized as a quasi-independent film festival, the Santa Fe Jewish Film Festival. And it's been remarkably successful. The films we're bringing are the same ones you'd see if you went to the major Jewish film festivals in New York or San Francisco, but you get to save the airfare and you don't have to foot the hotel bill to do it.
And you don't have to pay for San Francisco parking either.
That's right. That's a very good point.
$10 to $20 an hour. Thank you very much. So what's left of this year's films? You're kind of coming up on the end of your season, right?
Right. Actually, our main season ended in May, and this is part of, we're just starting a very short summer season called Summer Sneaks, Cool Films for Hot Days. Our last film is going to be in July, and we are doing a sneak preview of the winner of the Israeli Academy Award for Best Picture, Fill the Void. And we are going to be joined via Skype from Israel by the film's director, who also won the Israeli Academy Award for Best Director. The film originally premiered at the Venice Film Festival to just absolutely rave reviews, so we're very, very excited about that one.
And this is the last, we're not talking about Hava Negila yet, we're talking about the last film in this festival.
Yes, that's correct.
Festival.
Yes, right.
And it's going to be on July?
On July 11th, Thursday, July 11th at 7 p.m.
At CCA.
Yes.
Great. Okay, so, and then in August or September, you'll start the 2013-2014 season.
Exactly, it'll be in September.
And in the next year, you're going to have more films than you've had.
We're going to have more films. They'll be entertaining, informing, engaging, eclectic, and we're looking forward to a really interesting fourth season for us.
I do want you to say briefly what Fill the Void is about, because the topic is very interesting.
Yes. The film is about the ultra-Orthodox community. It is the director herself is a member of that community, and it's a highly unusual for to have a female ultra-Orthodox director. So it's an unusual glimpse into the community, and it's a story about a family where the husband of a young woman dies. And in the Orthodox community, there is an obligation that there is a sister for that sister to marry the husband. And so it's a story about the sort of the conflict that comes up between one's obligation to your religious tradition and feelings of the heart, which may not be the same. So it's a fabulous movie. The story is very interesting. It is an absolute unique view of the ultra-Orthodox community from someone within that community, and it's a female perspective.
I can't wait to see that film, because we as Americans, especially out west, understand so little about Orthodoxy and Judaism, unless you're in a large urban center where there's a very active Orthodox community. I know there is an Orthodox community here in Santa Fe, but most of us are probably not exposed that much to Orthodoxy. And we have lots of prejudices and biases and just plain misconceptions about what Orthodoxy is about.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the strengths of the film, is that the Orthodox community is very complex. It's not unidimensional. And this gives you a much more nuanced view of the community and the issues that they face. And oftentimes we don't get that. We get sort of either a black and white picture, and this one is much more nuanced.
Right. So we're talking with Marcia Torobin, who's the director of the Jewish Film Festival. And coming up, the next film coming up is this Sunday at CCA. And you can go to her website, santafejff.org, if you want to find out about tickets to that screening of Hava Negila.
Right.
And I also want to mention that it will be screening later at CCA.
There will. I will say at the screening that we're doing, which is a sneak preview, I'll be speaking with Diana in just a minute, but Diana's going to be joining us live for a Q&A. After that, we're going to have a deli reception, and we are also going to have live klezmer music. So it's just, it's really exciting.
And what time is that event?
The screening is at 4 o'clock, and if you purchase tickets in advance, you'll save some money.
So go online to santafejff.org. to get tickets to that sneak preview of Hava Nagila that's this coming Sunday at CCA. And now I want to talk about that film. Diana Taylor, the cinematographer, is here with us. Yesterday, Diana and I sat down in my living room and screened the film together because she hadn't seen it in a while. She's a filmmaker who's working on many films at once. And we giggled all afternoon. And first of all, I want to ask you guys, do you think there's anyone in the United States who hasn't heard Hava Nagila or doesn't know that melody?
I will tell you, after seeing the film, I know there's no one that hasn't heard it, because although I thought it was, I knew it was clearly people that are Jewish know it, but after you see the film, you will know that everybody knows it.
Okay, well, Diana, do you want to sing a few bars for us?
And I think we should all sing a few bars.
Should we do the la-la version and invite the listener audience to be singing in their shower or running around their house or whatever they're doing right now? Okay, take it away, Diana.
Hava Nagila, Hava Nagila, La 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 La.
Okay, well, maybe we're not gonna. Diana's doing very well. I don't know if we could get a job, you know, singing, but anyway, now you know which song we're talking about. Well, you know, I was reminded of my own mother, who grew up in a very tiny town in western Kansas, and once told me she had never seen a black person until she was 20 and moved to the city. You know, so a lot of people still live in semi-isolation compared to others of us. But Diana, tell me about how this film came about and how you got involved in it.
So first I want to credit the amazing producer and director, Roberta Grossman, whose idea this was, whose love child this was. And she's a remarkable filmmaker who's made films on social justice, around Native Americans, but has also made films about Judaism. She made a beautiful film called Blessed is the Match about the story of Hannah Senish.
But most of her movies are serious movies,
most of
right?
her movies are extremely serious. Mm-hmm. She's a great historian. She understands history very well and has studied history. And this was the first film where her extraordinary comedic talents could come to the front. She wanted to make a very short film about her. She thought, oh, it would be fun. I can make a little short film about Hava Nagila. And as she began to research it, she realized the story was much more complex than she ever imagined, which is true of many subjects that we delve into, that it had a history that was mysterious and that it had a controversy involved with it, that it had reached far and wide, and that everyone from Connie Francis to, you know, Glenn Campbell to, you know, the most extraordinary array of people have performed it all over the world. So she started on this quest to find the origins of Hava Nagila.
In the movie, she calls it the Hava Quest.
The Hava Quest, right. And ultimately, we traveled to Israel, and then we traveled to the Ukraine, where we found its origins to exist.
And you shot a bar mitzvah in L.A., a very highfalutin bar mitzvah.
And a wedding in L.A.
Uh-huh.
A wedding in L.A. And so we did both of those, which were really fun. And which included, of course, Hava Nagila, both of them.
Right.
So, and the raising of the chairs.
Now, did you know anything about Hava Nagila before you shot this film?
Well, ironically, my mother, although not Jewish, after my father passed away, she's a singer,
uh-huh.
and she sang as a cantor in the local synagogue. And so, because there was no appropriate singer, and they hired her, which was really lovely, and she needed the money badly, and so I did know about Hava Nagila. I didn't know its history, like we then discovered, but so it's a funny side story.
Yeah, so this film actually combines, it's factual. Everything in it is factual. There's real history about this song, which actually comes from a psalm, right? Hava Nagila. Well, first, tell us what, there's an Asian singer at the very beginning of the film, and what does he tell us that Hava Nagila means?
He's a nightclub singer. And what he says is, Hava Nagila. Hava means, Nagila is a food. And Hava Nagila. That's it. That's what it means.
He never told you what he thought a Nagila was.
No, he never told you what a Nagila
burrito,
is.
A burrito, a crepe, yeah, you right. know, yeah. Uh-huh.
It's
a knish. Yeah, the whole film is filled with, I wanted to know, did you come up with the idea of doing the man on the street interviews?
Well, Roberta and I talked about doing the, so we call it Pop Box. And so we went to New York, to delis in New York. We went to Cantor's in L.A. We went and then did Man on the Street and asked people everywhere, do you know the song? And we'd be forced to sing some bars of it and to see them. Like, oh, yeah, isn't it a polka? Oh, yeah, isn't it this? Isn't it that? So it's everyone knows it and everyone has some resonance with it.
All right.
And what the film ended up allowing us to do was to really tell some very interesting history tied to the song that opens up the world of sort of Jewish history, but more than that, sort of social history of the last 100 years, really.
It really kind of puts a framework on the whole diaspora, the entire movement. And in fact, there's some really clever usage of graphics with little lines going from Eastern Europe over to Jerusalem and over to the United States about how this song traveled with Jews as they immigrated to other places. Yeah, it does so. I mean, as we watched this film, I was really struck by the fact it's so funny. It is so funny.
I thought,
my God, if we taught history this way to young people, we would all want to be historians, because I'm never going to forget some of the history that I learned in that movie. Now, tell us about Harvey the Bobblehead.
Well, there's a Harvey Nagila doll who wears a little black suit, and he's sort of in the Hasidim outfit, and he's quite divine. And we discovered him in a store in Los Angeles, and he bobs and sings Hava Nagila when you wind him up. And he became the mascot, if you will, of the film and takes us on this journey, and he's quite marvelous. Yeah. And then we have two extraordinary musicologists and music historians, Josh Kuhn and James Leffler, who fill in the blanks, some amazing Jewish scholars in Israel. But I have to say, the film will appeal to everyone because it is really our social lives comes to the fore in the most marvelous way, and it is so funny, and you just howl.
I think that really is the strength of the film, is it's a film that's fun, it entertains, but you learn something. Mm-hmm. And as you were saying, if the history were taught that way, we would all know a lot more.
Thanks, Marcia. You know, one of the things I loved about the film was the captions. It's very camp. It's very camp. And she, you know, up will pop a caption that says, how Jews moved to the suburbs, or how to be a Jew in the suburbs was one of the captions. You know, you're just howling watching this. And sort of how that whole movement.
Very 50s, great stock footage, really, really amazing. Her sense of irony is really divine, and we had so much fun making this film. I mean, we laughed all the way through.
Yeah.
And yet, it was very difficult to make the film. It took us 3 years to make it. Mm-hmm. Roberta sacrificed a lot to make it. And, you know, even social, she did social, fundraising campaigns, you know, on the web when she'd run out of money and then have to stop and start again. And at first, people didn't take her very seriously with it. And I think about two-thirds of the way through, she had a wonderful trailer, and people began to go, this is amazing.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you came across a lot of things you didn't know, just as you might have if you were researching a book. Tell us about the dueling families.
So about halfway into the research, Roberta called me and she said, you cannot believe it. This Hava Nagila actually has a controversy, which of course is great for a film when there's a controversy. But it turns out that there are two men, who were attributed with putting the words and music to Hava Nagila together. One is Mr. Edelson and one is Mr. Nathanson. And the two of them, their two families, both claim the rights to that. No, it's my father, my grandfather who did it. No, it's my grandfather who did it.
And so we went to both
the families, and we met the families and discussed this with both of them. And we make no judgment about who we think it really is, but it was really quite a forceful controversy for a while.
Right. So tell us also, I mean, one of the most marvelous things that happened in this film happened in the Ukraine when you were shooting there. Tell us about that marvelous synchronicity.
So we made our way to a small town called Satagora in Ukraine, where the Jewish population had been quite lush and wonderful. And there was a court there run by an Israel freedman who was the rabbi, they say, a rabbi. And by now, sadly, there are no Jews left there. And it's a long story how we got there. But so there we were, standing in the courtyard of a crumbling synagogue, a beautiful haunted building that was absolutely in disrepair. There was no one there. A guard had to let us in. We'd been filming, and Roberta sort of sadly looked at me, and she said, well, let's make some beautiful abstract images of this, and hopefully we can use this as an image of memory. And so I set upon doing all these beautiful abstracts of the building. And as we were about to leave, we see a Hasidic beautiful young man walking towards us with a gaggle of young men.
He's a rabbi.
And it turns out he was a rabbi. We didn't know he was a rabbi. We thought perhaps, you know, we didn't know. And so he said sort of, well, who are you? And we sort of said, well, who are you? And it turned out that he was the great-great-grandfather of the rabbi, Israel Friedman. The great-great-grandson, excuse me. His great-great-grandfather was the rabbi there. And Roberta had been looking for descendants all that time, and it was the most unbelievable synchronous moment ever. If we'd left 2 minutes later, I mean earlier, if he'd arrived 2 minutes later, we never would have crossed paths. And so there we were standing with the descendants of this very person who, was, of course, knew Hava Megillah, and he was bringing his students. He lives in Manchester, England, and he was bringing his students to hear all about this particular sort of this, what do I want to say, this heart center of the Jewish
Hava
culture and Hava Megillah and the Jewish culture in Ukraine.
The song Hava Megillah is believed by most people to have had its roots in a nigun. That's a wordless a wordless tune Hebrew that came from this town in the Ukraine.
Yes, right.
And so I want to say that not only was it a fabulous synchronicity that this guy just shows up, but you, Diana, you saw this guy coming, walking with his students, and she turned on her camera and captured the whole thing live, including Roberta's voice going, "Who are you?" It was a great moment. I'm talking with Marcia Torabin, the director of the Jewish Film Festival in Santa Fe, and Diana Taylor, the cinematographer of the film Hava Megillah, which is going to be showing this Sunday at 4 o'clock at CCA. It's a preview, sneak preview for the Jewish Film Festival, and you can go on to santafejff.com if you'd like to get cheaper tickets in advance.
Santafejff.org.
I'm sorry, .org.
Yes,
yeah, thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
And then this film is also going to be screened by CCA in a limited run beginning on June 28th. So if you can't get there this Sunday or they sell out, and I think they are close to selling out, you can go June 28th or in the days following that. You'll just have to check out the CCA schedule. It's a great film, but I do want to keep talking about it a little bit more. Despite the fact that this is primarily a comedy, or feels mostly like a comedy, there's some really tender moments in this film. And there were two different rabbis, one of whom characterizes the meaning of the song lyrics. Now, technically, Hava Megillah means "Let us rejoice." And it comes from Psalms. It's directly, the words are basically based on a psalm. And this rabbi, I'm sorry, I don't remember which one he was, he says, you know, that in Hava Megillah embodies the paradox of life that is so central to Jewish culture, that says, isn't life wonderful? And I'm going to die. Yeah, you know,
beautiful.
And holds those two things.
Yeah.
And then another rabbi, very, very famous rabbi, who really started the Jewish renewal movement in the United States, Rabbi Zalman Shachter Shalomi, he sings it. Do you remember? He sings it without words as a nigun, very slowly. And he says, you know, you have to leave the words aside in order to hear the yearning and the longing for God and connectedness.
Exactly.
That is at the basis of this song. And usually we think of Hava Megillah as a celebration song, don't we?
Yeah, we do.
Yeah, it's sung at weddings, it's sung at bar mitzvahs. Absolutely, it's thought of in a very celebratory context.
And one other great thing about this film is the dancing. I mean, for most people, you think of Hava Megillah and you think of a wedding, and everybody's dancing the chora. And one of the narrator at the very beginning says, you know, you're at this wedding, you know, you don't even know. She's sort of blah, blah, it's a wedding, right? And then that song happens.
And the DNA of all of us jumps into action. It's like embedded in the DNA, and everyone in seconds are on the dance floor.
Diana, tell us about the older lady, the dancer.
Who's an exquisite, do you remember her name?
I don't.
Okay.
I don't.
I knew you would ask me this, and I loved her and adored her. But there's an older, beautiful woman dancer who's known for her choreography in Israel. And she led a large group of people, a very large group of people, in learning the Horah in Israel, who had given up basically learning the Horah, that the Horah is sort of passé now, and that other kinds of folk dancing has taken in with more contemporary songs. And it was a really, really, really marvelous moment. And she also sings it for us and dances it for us in a very beautiful way.
She must be 80.
She was 80.
And she was did a fabulous job dancing.
Yeah.
And then there's a scene where, tell us about that, the scene with the dancers in the gym.
That was the
one you were talking about.
Where they're
sort of, they're doing all this contemporary dance, and she teaches them how to do the Horah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's such a wonderful, wonderful film. I'm going to encourage everybody to check this out. Hava Nagila is going to be at CCA at 4:00 this coming Sunday.
Along with a Dolly reception and klezmer music.
Yeah,
and
the
Diana,
klezmer music will keep you wiggling.
Yeah, you can't miss that.
And Diana will be there.
And I will be there. And the new CCA projection system has been put in, a brand new digital projection system. It's top of the state of the art in America. CCA is really, the Cinematheque is really, really flourishing right now.
Yeah.
Gorgeous, gorgeous new facility.
And I want to recognize Diana for her service on the CCA board. I know you're doing a lot for the Center for Contemporary Arts, which gives us so much in our community. Marcia Torben of the Jewish Film Festival, thank you for being with me this morning. Diana Taylor, thank you so much for being with me this morning. And Diana, Diana's going to have a new film coming out next year. She's working on a documentary for HBO about Dorothea Lange, the very, very famous photographer who happens to be her grandmother. And so we're really looking forward to seeing that. And thank you again, both of you, so much for being here. And we're going to take a little break. Please stay tuned to the Radio Cafe. Good morning. We're back at the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. And my next guest is author Christine Barber, a former Santa Fe, New Mexican editor turned novelist. She lives down in Albuquerque, and I'm really glad you're here with us this morning, Christine.
Hi, Hollis. How are you?
I'm good. Before we get started, I want to give our listeners a little background. This is your third published novel in a series. The first novel you wrote, The Replacement Child, won the Tony Hillerman Prize for Best Mystery Novel, and it also was a New York Times Notable Crime Novel. And your second book, Bonefire, came out in 2010, and it won the New Mexico Book Award.
Yes.
So I see great things for this third book of yours, When the Devil Doesn't Come. So I'm going to give our readers a little synopsis.
Okay.
Well, first of all, I want to say you're going to be reading from this book at Collected Works Bookstore down on Galisteo Street this coming Monday. The reading starts at 6 p.m., and I believe Marie Romero Cash will be the first reader. She's an artist-turned writer who's reading from her mystery, Treasure Among the Shadows. So everybody can show up next Monday night and hear Marie and you. So in your latest book, When the Devil Doesn't Come, my own little synopsis is your protagonist, Detective Sergeant Gil Montoya of the Santa Fe Police Department, and his sidekick, Joe Phillips, an East Coast transplant to Santa Fe, are investigating a series of home invasion murders. And then your other protagonist, Lucy Nuro, has been demoted from the city editor's job at the local paper, which you call the Capital Tribune, to a feature editor's job that seems to mostly involve writing baby announcements and wedding announcements and obituaries. And Lucy is also an emergency medical technician, an EMT, who volunteers for the fire department in her off hours. So she has lots of insider information about the home invasion murders. So first of all, we need to talk about how much does this story correspond, your setup correspond to your real life at the New Mexican back in the old days?
Well, when I first started writing back in, like it was 99, 2000, I was working at the New Mexican and had just started as an EMT. And they always say, write what you know. So that's what I did. And so a lot of it does correspond as far as like the medicine is real. And a lot of the cases, of course, I've changed names and changed what happened, but all of that is real. And a lot of what happens at the newspaper is real.
But you're not going to reveal this morning the names of the people you base any of these characters on, right?
I have done that in the past, and I don't know that I want to embarrass those people, but I actually do. I do have a tendency to base my characters on actual people I know, or their conglomeration of people. Like, I squish them together into one person. I just feel like, from a realism point of view, that's a better way to go about it. I think it's very easy to end up with caricatures.
Mm-hmm.
And I've noticed that's something that is a big pet peeve of mine in books. So I try very hard not to do that.
The people, the characters are sometimes too pat. They're too wrapped up.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. So, Christine, you really are an EMT, and you really, tell me about that.
I took my first EMT class in 1999. Totally fell in love with it. And at the same time, I was working at the newspaper. So the newspaper was fantastic because they would let me leave to go run calls because they saw it as a public service. And so I was an EMT for quite some time, a volunteer with Santa Fe County. I worked closely with the city, who's fantastic, and just had a really great experience with that.
And so you just wove that all together in here.
Yes.
Yeah. So tell me about you wanted to come up with these two protagonists. Lucy has a lot of ethical conflicts, and tell us, why did you do it that way?
So I kind of wanted these two characters who I actually kind of think are both kind of parts of myself and maybe parts of a lot of people, which is we have the person Lucy who is a little less ethical, not really, she is, but she has her own way of doing things, and then there's Gil Montoya, who is much more dependable and much more responsible and much more staid. And I kind of feel like those two halves, the fun, carefree half and the more responsible half, kind of meet each other to a certain extent. So that's kind of why I did it to that point of view, because I have a friend who keeps calling me a safety dog because I look both ways when I cross the street. I put my seatbelt on. I follow the rules. I'm a rule follower. And so I wanted to have that shown. But I also have a sense of humor, so that's why I kind of put it into Lucy.
The two of those people, you know, are so realistic. Detective Sergeant Gil Montoya, you know, he's a locally born and raised Hispanic guy, and he goes to visit his mother every day. and I find that very, you know, touching and endearing and true to character for, you know, the Hispanic population here. So many people are deeply connected to their families, and their families are still around them. So,
yeah, no, I really wanted to capture that because when I first moved to Santa Fe in 1996, what I was really struck by was the sense that everybody knew everybody and they were all still in the same place. So for someone who's from the Midwest, now in the Southwest, who doesn't live anywhere near her family, and it was never any expectation I would live near my family, it's really interesting to have almost this kind of sense of, you know, wandering to come here where there it's like such a sense of place and such a sense of community and family.
Yeah, and you describe something that happens here in the local culture as proving your ties. Explain
yes.
what that is.
Well, in this, you say this constantly, and it's very interesting to me, is if you're Northern New Mexico Hispanic and you meet someone else who's Northern New Mexico Hispanic, you kind of have this often have this interaction where it's like, oh, you're one of the Anayas from Galisteo. Oh, I'm one of the Anayas. I have a grandmother who's an Anaya from, you know, Chupadero. Or it's just, oh, yeah, no, I think I know your grandmother. She went to school with such. If you look at conversation, a lot of times there needs to be this establishment of, this is who you are. This is who I am. We both have a connection here. Now we can talk. And I love that.
Right. It's a really beautiful thing. And the same thing, I think, happens in the Native American community
yes.
here.
Mm-hmm.
And then probably to a lesser degree in longstanding Anglo families here.
Yes.
But those of us who are relative newcomers, I came here in 87, so I'm never, you know, I'm still a newcomer,
yes.
right? But then we start to interact with that
yes.
because of the strong family ties here. You know, for the first time in my life, I know three or four generations of the same family.
Yes, exactly.
You know, and I'll say, oh, you know, I knew his mother. She's gone now. But, you know, they're having a little baby. And it's a really special thing about our lovely culture here. And speaking of Chupadero, which you just did, one of the things author Christine Barber, I'm speaking with right now, does so very well in this book is you just weave so much culture into this. And there, as I read it, I kept highlighting these strange things. I mean, I, having been a writer and an editor here for a very long time, I feel like I'm pretty informed about our culture. And yet there were so many things that I didn't know. And one of them was the meaning of the word Chupadero.
Well, so I actually lived in Chupadero with a curandera, so. But it really actually means the place that sucks. And what it...
So wait, slow down, Christine. The place that...
The place that sucks. And okay. I did not know if I was allowed to say that on radio. But what that actually kind of refers to is there's a spring there. Uh-huh. And so kind of like Oho means spring, that also means spring. And so, yes, you have some very interesting place names.
Yeah, and you talked about the inside of a kiva in Nambe Pueblo.
I
thought no Anglo was ever allowed inside a kiva.
I was in Nambe Pueblo several years ago. I was there for the dances, and at that point, they were allowing people into the kiva. So I was able to go in and get a look inside. It was really phenomenal. I actually couldn't believe it happened either, and it was really just such an amazing thing. I was really, you know, grateful that was able to happen.
I'm talking with Christine Barber of Albuquerque. She's the author of When the Devil Doesn't Come, her latest book. She's going to read a collected works next Monday, June 17th at 6 p.m. So tell me, Christine, what are the central elements of this book, and what prompted you to put these things together?
So I seem to have this way of writing books where I think of things in the area that I just really, really like. And I want to kind of stick together into a book, and then I figure out a mystery that works with those. It's kind of an odd way of coming about it. But so I kind of wanted to show Los Alamos, because I feel like that in contrast with the Pueblos, which is something else I wanted to show. And, the local Hispanic population here in Santa Fe, I thought those things were a very interesting mix. Los Alamos is fairly new, and it's this incredibly powerful international presence.
You mean the Los Alamos National Laboratory,
exactly.
Not just the town.
Not
uh-huh.
just the town. And then I wanted to write about the Santa Fe Sheriff's Posse because they go around on horses, and I thought that was cool. And then I wanted to write about the state pen riots because I just thought that was a very interesting thing in the state pen itself, which they're giving tours of now once a month. It's just a creepy place.
You somehow got all of that together.
Somehow. I don't know you how.
Yeah. So do you read other mystery writers?
I used to. I don't really do it that much anymore, mainly because when I read other mysteries, I'm editing them constantly now, and it's not that relaxing.
Who did you like to read before you started writing mysteries?
I always liked Dashiell Hammett, and then more contemporary Elizabeth George, and those kinds of people, Sue Grafton, but it is difficult to read the more current ones now. Sherlock Holmes, of course, is always a great, a great read, so I kind of go back to the classics now.
Yeah, and are you working on a new book yet?
No, not yet, and we will see how this one goes.
How true to life are the stories of these home invasions?
Actually, I'm basing this off a series of home invasions that was occurring in Albuquerque 10 years ago. And it was just this, we had this week to 2 weeks of just every day was some crazy home invasion. And so I was always intrigued by that because I feel like a home invasion is a very different kind of crime. A murder is a one-on-one kind of thing. A home invasion is a group of people who have previously agreed to go into someone's home with the intention of that person being there. They do this on purpose. And so the robbery is almost secondary to the terrorization that they, that they incur on the family. And so I feel like that is a gang mentality that I thought was fascinating. How do you even come up with that? You know, like, how do you find four people and go, hey, let's go break into this house and totally mess with this family and then maybe kill them? I mean, it's a very interesting dynamic.
Yeah, psychologically.
Yes.
Where does that come from?
I have no idea.
And all the places in the novel, are they all real places here in Santa Fe?
Yes. They are all real places. You can go visit them and you can find them. And if you don't know where they are, I can tell you.
You told me at one point that you wrote most of your first novel driving around in Santa Fe.
Yes. I was, at the time, I was undergoing treatment. And so I wasn't able to work. And so instead of being at work and instead of sitting at home and feeling, you know, depressed because I was in the middle of having medical treatment, I thought I'm going to drive around and write. And that's actually how the first book started. And I was, so it was in 99 and I had just moved here in 96. So it was still very new to me. So driving around and seeing all these amazing places was just so fantastic, you know, and a great way to feel better.
Right. So you would take a notebook with you?
Yes. Uh-huh. Take a notebook, amazing. And I would sketch things, and you know, I would hear tidbits of conversation, and you know, overheard conversations and stuff. One of my favorite things to do is to write down overheard conversations, because you know, people aren't gonna check their words And so it gets to be a lot more realistic. So,
right. So that book, you finished the book, the first book, The Replacement Child, about when?
About 2000, 2001.
And then tell the listeners how that book came together. I mean, how it got published.
So I finished the book in 2000, 2001. I'm totally proud of myself going, I'm going to sell this book. So I get usually when you do a book, you have to get an agent, and then the agent sells it to a publishing company. And so I got myself a really high-powered agent. She represented the Martin Luther King estate and, like, you know, all this. It went nowhere. I mean, like, nowhere. And so by about 2004, I kind of had to accept that my dream of publishing was completely dead. And so, you know, depression ensued, maybe some crying. And then in 2007, they announced this, the Hillerman Prize, the first one, and said, a mystery set in the Southwest. And so a couple friends of mine were like, you have a mystery novel set in the Southwest. Why don't you put it in? And so I did. I put it in for the contest. And I so did not, because, I mean, really, this was a dream that was dead. Like, my heart was like, I have to shut this part of my heart off because it's not going to happen. So I left the country.
You mean you went on a vacation?
Not a vacation. It was a working vacation. Oh. So, like, I was working in a medical clinic in Peru, in the middle of nowhere. I changed my address. I changed my phone number. Everything. I didn't have a home. I was, you know, and so it took quite some time to track me down in the middle of the mountains of Peru.
Did you get a letter or a phone call?
Phone call. The editor who at the St. Martin's Press, where I got published, they couldn't find me.
Well, explain that connection between the Tony Hillerman Award and the
Tony
press.
The Tony Hillerman Award is offered by St. Martin's Press. And so when you win the award, you get $10,000 and you get published by St. Martin's Press. And so the editor there was trying to find me. And so he knew I used to work at the New Mexican because from my bio. So he's calling around the New Mexican. And just as he's calling and the person answers the phone and says, I don't know where Christine is. We haven't seen her in years, because I had quit by that point. One of my friends who knew exactly where I was and had just talked to me in the middle of the Andes was like, wait, who's that? And so that's how they were able to actually send the phone call my way. And it was very odd.
Wow. That's really something. So you totally lost your dream. You let go of it. You were like, I'm going to start my life over, do something else. I'm never going to write a novel again.
Yes.
Maybe. And then you won the Tony Hillerman Award.
Yes. And it completely changed everything.
Yeah. And then they asked you after that,
to write the second one, The Bone Fire, and then the third, The One the Devil Doesn't Show. So, yeah.
When you started, did you think this would become a series?
No, but you always kind of have a dream in the back of your, you know, heart or mind, whatever that might be, and think, oh, this would be great if it was a series. But I didn't necessarily go into it with that thinking.
Did you write down, are you the kind of person who sketches out little, does a new story come into your mind and you sketch it out for maybe later consideration?
Yes, absolutely. Oh. I have several big boxes in my room of things that say, for future writing. And it's just these weird things that I've collected over the years. Things that I normally would not have in my life. So
for example, on this current novel, you might have had some articles about the state pen or Peter Eichstätt's book. Not Peter Eichstätt's book. Somebody's book.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so I have those things in there. I have a little booklet that tells you, like, how to properly shoot up heroin, which I don't know how to do that. So I figured that was a good reference book to have. And so that's kind of the things I have in this little box, are just these kind of odd pieces.
You do read interesting things. Christine is a very, I can say, I know this for a fact, she's a very multifaceted personality. You came in and sat down this morning and you are reading a 2-inch thick book called First Aid. and it's for some sort of test you're going to take?
Yes, it's for the USMLE. I'm in medical school, so I will be taking the first of three tests that you have to take in order to be a doctor. They're the national tests in a year, so it's time to start studying.
So in your spare time, besides being, you're an EMT, but you're not working as an EMT
correct.
But now you're in medical school.
Yes.
So you write in the morning and go to medical school in the afternoon? How does that work?
Oh, no, it's not nearly as neat as that. I go to medical school, and then, like, at 2 o'clock in the morning, I'll be, like, getting ready to go to bed, and I'll be like, oh, wait, I have this great idea for the book, and then I'll have to sit there and write till 5. So, no, it's not that neat. Like, I'll think of these crazy things, and it's a very, very weird process. And then I'll not get sleep, and I'll think that there's bugs crawling on me, and it's hilarious, so... Every time I don't get enough sleep, I think there's bugs crawling on me. So that's why I know I haven't had enough sleep.
That's interesting.
It sounds
Christine Barber, author. Here's her psychology right out there for everybody to look at. The bug crawling thing. So one of the themes that is sort of a subtext in this book and also in The Replacement Child, I mean, it starts at the very beginning, is Lucy's issue with alcoholism or drinking.
Yes, yes.
Why did you include that?
Well, I have a lot of friends, single female friends, who this is an issue for. They start with a drink at night, and then it ends up kind of spiraling into this kind of secret drinking thing. And the more I talk to women, young women, the more this is kind of an issue, where they go home at night and one glass of wine turns into a bottle of wine eventually. And then they, over years, and then they eventually have to come to the realization they have a drinking problem. And so that's kind of what I wanted to include, just because I saw it so much with a lot of my friends having to go through it. And I feel like that there's certain consequences that happen when you start to do that with your life, because you can't hold that together for too long. So that's kind of what I wanted to show. I thought it was a pretty realistic way to go for her.
Yeah, Lucy has a tendency to hang out in the bar with other reporters and editors
yes.
late at night.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, gets into a little bit of trouble that way.
Yes, exactly.
Is she ever going to get sober?
You know what? We'll find out. Part of me wants to not have her get sober, just because I think in a lot of ways that is a reality, is that you have a struggle that goes on and on and on of trying to get sober, getting sober for a while, then going back. I mean, it's the relapse part of addiction. But part of me, from a reader's point of view, would be like, of course she gets sober. So,
right. And but also, she, without that aspect, she might become too much of a good girl.
She might find someone else to, you know, take up her time and be a bad girl. It's just, I don't know that she sees herself as a good or bad girl. She just kind of blows with the wind, you know. She's pretty carefree.
So when you write these books, you mentioned the other day when we were talking, people are always interested in process. Do you have an outline of the whole mystery and its conclusion in your head as you start to write?
Oh, God, no. And plus, it also changes as I go through. I really do start with places that I'm really interested in. And so then I might go visit those places, and then I'll write a description of those places. From that description, I'll go, oh, hey, you know what? What character would really find this and, like, really have this type of description in their head is Gil. This is the way he would describe something. Great. Well, now I'm going to figure out how to make Gil go to this place and figure out, okay, Gil will go to this place as part of a mystery if this kind of person got killed in this situation. And so that's how I end up going through these processes. Is I just wanted to kind of show these different areas of Santa Fe, and I want to have the characters kind of weave their personalities in those things.
Do you think of this process as one that's completely rational, or is there sort of this mysterious, unconscious thing going on at the same time?
You know, okay, I really would like to say that there isn't some mysterious, unconscious thing going on, because I hear a lot of writers say things like, well, the character writes themselves, or I had nothing to do with the character, you know, and they're like, no, you totally made that character up. You totally had something to do with that character. But it does seem kind of strange that I do this process like this, and it kind of works out. I don't know how it works out. So I could just give credit to my brain and say, my brain figures out how to make this work.
Right. Your unconscious mind is working on it.
Exactly.
All the time, when you're not thinking about it
exactly.
consciously.
And so I think that, you know, from pattern solving and problem solving, my brain works on it constantly. So, no, there's no mysterious process. I just have a weird brain.
Well, we know that's true, Christine.
Oh, thank you, Holly.
So, you know, I have to tell you, yesterday morning, I had to be up in Penasco.
Yes.
And I was reading The Replacement Child. I'd already finished the new book, which is When the Devil Doesn't Come,
mm-hmm.
which I failed to mention has an aspect of Las Posadas in it.
Yes,
the,
it does.
The Christmas tradition here that's really beautiful. And so I'd taken your first novel, which I read second, with me up to Penasco, and I left it behind.
Oh, no.
I drive home. I get all my stuff out of my car, and I go looking for it because I'm going to read it while I'm eating lunch. You know, I'm one of those, I can
right.
never eat without reading if I don't
yes.
have a companion. So, and I couldn't find the book. And I'm on the phone making panic phone calls. I'm thinking, what I'm trying to say is, your books are page turners. They are just, you cannot put them down. I fall in love with the character. So I'm making panic phone calls, trying to figure out, where did I leave The Replacement
Thank
Child?
You.
I'm going online to the Santa Fe Public Library to see if I can get a copy, like, now. so I can finish the book. I finally found it's up there. Luckily, a friend of mine lives in Penasco, and I emailed her and said, can you go pick up my book and bring it to me when you come down to Santa Fe in the next few days? So I still haven't read the end of that book yet. But so what about, you know, you said you're not quite ready to start your next book, but what are the elements out there that you're thinking about?
I think I try to think of what people might not know about Santa Fe, like they might find interesting. So one of the things that I find very interesting is the idea of rodeo. When I first moved here, I moved to Gallup, and in Gallup you have two things that you can do in the weekend, which is go to a rodeo or go to a powwow. So I did a lot of both. And I find rodeos fascinating. The idea of they have groupies called buckle bunnies, and there's this whole process. I had friends who were barrel racers, and so I know that whole process, and they became state fair queens, and I love that aspect of it. It's just so Western. And then I'm really interested in, actually, we have some fairly big biker gangs here in Northern New Mexico, and their headquarters are up here. So I thought, well, those two things kind of sound like they're both really interesting. So I have to figure out how to put those two things together.
Rodeo and biker gangs.
Oh, and fires, wildland fires.
Right.
Because fighting a wildland fire is very different than fighting, because when the devil doesn't show, I have a structure fire. And in the other books, I have for learning how to be an EMT. And so I thought wildland firefighting is another aspect that people might not know about. Plus, you look outside today. I mean, it's, you know, this is a really weird way to live with all this smoke in the air and,
yes,
you know, having to deal with the fact that we can't see the mountains half the time now.
Right.
So.
Now, did you as an EMT go into burning structures?
Yes, I did.
Oh.
It's interesting. So as people become EMTs, and I became an EMT and a firefighter with a lot of people and friends, we were required in Santa Fe County to be EMT and firefighter and wildland. We kind of had to have all three. And so I'd had friends who'd be like, I love wildland firefighting. And then I had friends, I love structure firefighting. And of course I love the EMT. But we did have to go into structures. I was not particularly good at it. I was always wondering why we were saving people's belongings. But so this is why I'm not good at it. I'd be happy saving people. So, yes, I was a structure firefighter. I was bad at it.
Do you still have a lot of friends up here in the firefighting community?
Yeah, I still know a lot of people up here in firefighting.
So when you're writing something, do you ever find yourself having questions about?
Oh, yeah. I call them and be like, hey, can you remind me what this is, or what's the protocol for this thing, or what's this hose coupling do again? And
yeah, it's interesting because you left journalism, but you are still asking questions and still learning about a vast variety of things.
That's my favorite part of journalism.
Yeah, so I've been talking with Christine Barber, who is an old friend of mine. We worked together with New Mexican years and years and years ago, and she's a novelist. She's going to be reading at Collected Works Bookstore at 6 p.m. Monday, June 17th. That's this coming Monday. She'll be the second reader. Marie Romero Cash is going to first read from her mystery, and then Christine is going to be reading from her new book, When the Devil Doesn't Come. And Christine, it's been wonderful to have you here on the show with me today.
Thank you, Hollis.
And I want you to promise me that even though you may finish your MD and become a doctor, that you'll still keep writing on the side, because I need to know what's going to happen to Lucy Nuro and Detective Sergeant Gil Montoya, as do many of our listeners out there in Radio Land.
No problem. I will absolutely do that.
All right. Thanks so much, Christine.
Thank you, Hollis.
And we're out of here. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Hollis Walker. I'm sitting in for Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company.